Hello, you're listening to the Brainy Speech Therapist podcast. We're your hosts, Helen McLean and Jan McIntosh Brown. Here, we aim to look at all aspects of brain injury, from the research to the rehabilitation, and always through the lens of speech and language therapy. So, hello everybody, welcome to another episode of the Brainy Speech Therapist podcast. I'm Helen McLean, flying solo tonight. You'll have heard the previous episode with Jan, and I'm delighted to be speaking tonight with Professor Jenny Kitzinger. So, hello Jenny, thank you for giving up some of your time this evening to speak to me.
It's a pleasure. Hi Helen.
I'll ask you just first of all to maybe tell our listeners a little bit about your background.
Okay, well, I'm an academic. I trained in social anthropology and had a career where I was really looking at a range of social controversies, particularly around health or technology. And then in 2009, my own sister was in a car crash that left her in a prolonged disorder of consciousness. So I and my sister, Professor Celia Kitzinger, turned our attention and our academic skills to looking at the framing of this kind of serious brain injury and the treatment patients received and how decisions were made, particularly about life prolonging treatment. I now run a centre with Celia called the Coma and Disorders of Consciousness Research Centre. We've done over a decade of research now with families and healthcare professionals. And I also lead an e-learning programme to support staff learning about prolonged disorders of consciousness and how to care for this patient group.
So yeah, definitely you've worn many hats in your career, and it's, I have to say, there's a no way in the same league as yourself, but it's interesting. We've both come to the world of brain injury through a sibling having an acquired brain injury, and I think that maybe adds a different kind of perspective in how you approach your interests and your research and your clients. And certainly the training that you offer, I've taken part in some of that, and it's great, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes because I think not enough people know about it. So yeah, you're kind of speaking there about kind of the Coma and Disorders of Consciousness Research Centre, and obviously your kind of background in social anthropology, and I think you've done quite a lot of work around looking at the role of the media in representation of brain injury, and we'll speak a bit about that. But I think it'd be helpful to have people hear a little bit about actually what is a prolonged disorder of consciousness. Could you explain a little bit about that?
Yes, so prolonged disorder of consciousness, it's a bit of a mouthful, so you'll probably often find me using the acronym PDOC, is the umbrella term that covers mainly the vegetative and the minimally conscious state, and that whole continuum of a disorder of consciousness. So the patient is either unconscious or perhaps has intermittent low-level consciousness. And the word prolonged is very important there. So prolonged disorder of consciousness is not the kind of falling unconscious for a few days. It's about the longer lasting period of time when the patient's in a disorder of consciousness. And this is usually a sign of the most severe forms of brain injury.
Okay, yeah. And I think that's really helpful to think of it in terms of that continuum, isn't it? That's what I've kind of learned over the years, and I know it's what kind of all the kind of guidance says, is that continuum from coma to vegetative state to minimally conscious state to being emerged. And I know that we were both interested in maybe speaking a bit about kind of the role of speech and language therapy within PDOC. What has been your experience maybe with your sister or over the years from a kind of academic point of view?
Well, both, I suppose, from my personal experience as a family member, but also from the research I've done. The speech and language therapist is, of course, a key member of the multidisciplinary team that cares for patients in disorders of consciousness from the early acute stage or hyperacute stages right the way through to any kind of rehabilitation or assessment setting and in long-term care. And it's quite different, I think, from how the popular image of the speech and language therapist, which kind of, well, you think it's what it says on the tin, don't you? The job title is speech and language therapist. So family members, when they first encounter a speech and language therapist for a patient in a disorder of consciousness, think that person, that professional has come in to restore speech and language to the person in PDOC. And of course, for many patients in PDOC, that won't be possible or will be only at a very low level. So I think speech and language therapists who may be very skilled at, you know, dysphasia or helping people manage swallow difficulties or whatever can feel a bit challenged. And certainly the popular image of this profession can be challenged by the role that these therapists have in relation to the most severely brain injured patients, which I guess covers trying to be involved in assessing consciousness for the purpose of diagnosis and prognosis, issues around swallow management, issues about trying to establish whether there is any form of communication. And we're not normally talking about language. We may be talking about using a switch just to indicate a yes-no response, for example. And then, of course, speech and language therapists have a key role around tracheostomy management. So I guess that's the kind of areas that speech and language therapists need to adapt their skills and develop their skills for working with this patient group alongside the really key issue of best interest decision making, because patients in PDOC can't give or withhold consent to therapies or interventions. So it's very important that anybody working with this patient group has a good grasp on best interests and can work within that framework.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more about that. And I think personally, obviously, sitting here as a speech and language therapist, I do think we are kind of uniquely positioned as a profession whose kind of core skill set is around listening and having conversations. And in this situation, it will apply to the family members. And I find myself maybe being the person that can kind of say, so what do you think that your family member would want to be happening in this situation? And because obviously the family members are now that person's voice and that person's kind of means of having their kind of intentions or what they would like to have happen kind of said, and it's such an emotional time, isn't it? And I think, again, you know, speech therapists, we're a highly empathetic bunch, and not that other professions aren't, but it is very much a core skill for speech and language therapists. And it's interesting, in my experience, not many speech therapists do feel confident to work with this particular client group. And maybe hospital teams don't include speech therapists as much as perhaps they should, because we're maybe looking at a person who on the surface can't communicate. But exactly like you say, it's about exploring other options, whether that's switches or other alternative communication means. So it's great to hear from you that you're kind of really hearing the value that speech and language therapists can bring to this caseload.
And I'd certainly reflect back to you that certainly from the families that we've interviewed, and we've interviewed over 100 family members now and tracked patients through pathways over up to 10 years or more, the therapy teams are the ones who indeed are often showing empathy, who are spending time with families, who are indeed listening, who are asking those questions, you know, in this terrible situation, what would be the least worst option based on what you knew about this person's values, beliefs, wishes and feelings? Whereas sometimes doctors can parachute in and out, and they have the power to make the decisions often around key issues, particularly about life-sustaining treatment. But it's the therapy team part of the MDT So speech and language therapists, occupational therapists, speech and language therapists, and of course, psychologists who've stepped up and really helped create an engine of change in the UK to ensure much more person-centred care for this patient group.
And it's interesting, I think, over kind of recent years, learning more about how we go around getting to a diagnosis of some form of PDOC. So, for example, doing something called a SMART assessment, that it is more often than not therapy staff that will carry out these assessments, and is giving quite detailed feedback to families. And I've been in situations where there have been medics there and they've clearly been a bit out of their depth, for want of a better phrase. And it's the therapy staff that are maybe really kind of upping their skill set to be able to understand what it means for a person to be in PDOC and what that means in terms of the longer term care and management. You know, what kind of, if we're looking at placement somewhere, could this person come home, what that would mean for the family. And it's very much these sorts of conversations that are being led by therapy staff rather than medics. And it's interesting because they are very complex patients in terms of the care that they might need, and the psychological impact of having this and this loved one in this situation. And so I personally think, and I wonder what you think, Jenny, that has there maybe been a change in recent years around the upskilling of therapy staff to understand more and to be maybe taking the lead a little bit more in these situations?
Yes, and maybe it's an upskilling and a sense of empowerment. And I'll emphasise how important teamwork is across the MDT. I mean, both at a technical level, if you're going to do a good assessment, you need the nursing to have been right, so the patient is clean and comfortable, and not the medication is right, so they're not over-sedated. You need their positioning right. You need them not to be exhausted because the activities manager has just taken them out. It is absolutely a team process where everyone around that patient is working to maximize their ability to respond in assessments, for example, and to collect information in an informed way, in informal settings, as well as contributing to the kind of formal assessments like the WIM or the SMART. And yes, the kind of confidence I've seen develop from teams, I think also sort of spotting an injustice and thinking about this in terms of human rights, the human rights of these patients to have good assessments and the best opportunity to recover if that's what they would have wanted, but also the right not to have ongoing treatment and interventions if they wouldn't have wanted that. And it's, you know, the most disempowered you can be really is to be a PDOC patient. Mm. And so you need advocates around you, and that may be professionals. It may or may not be family, of course. I mean, some people are alienating from their family and would not have chosen their family to represent them. So although I use the shorthand family, I always realize I should also be saying friends or people who knew the patient well or know them well now and care about their welfare. And also, of course, sometimes you mentioned it's a very emotional time. Sometimes families can be so wrapped up with their own hopes, fears, confusion, they may not be in the best position to advocate for the patient. So it's very important that the professionals set the framework for consulting with families appropriately to inform the best interest decisions that they make.
Yeah, I think it's something that I think professionals occasionally we need to be actively reminding ourselves that families are going through an extremely difficult time. And because I've had that experience myself where you have maybe family members that are maybe not receptive to information or maybe not that happy about things, and it's coming from a place of grief almost. You know, they've had a very difficult, probably the most difficult thing that they've ever experienced has happened to them, and They don't know how what's going to happen, because there's a real kind of limbo to PDOC, isn't there?
Yes, and there's so much uncertainty at the beginning, although I think that is sometimes over-exaggerated in that what's very important is to talk about the likely spectrum of recovery. And in the past, there was too much focus on, well, is the person going to be in a permanent vegetative state? Full stop. And that was seen as the kind of benchmark. And that shift to talking about prolonged disorder of consciousness allows us to get away from almost fetishizing the diagnosis of the permanent vegetative state and begin to talk about a spectrum with a narrowing spectrum as time progresses and as appropriate treatments and assessments are carried out to make a more nuanced sort of person-centered engagement. Can I ask you whether your personal experience was before or after being a professional working in this field?
It was before, so yes, my brother has a brain injury, and yes, it was as a result of seeing the speech and language therapist working with him, my eyes were opened to this career path, and so I trained within a kind of a couple of years of that happening. And I'd always thought, yes, I would quite like to work with people with brain injuries, and here I am, 10 years down the line, I am.
What a lovely way of working with personal challenge and family tragedy.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because it was without a doubt an incredibly difficult time, and that's where I can fully appreciate that kind of limbo, because I have been there in that ICU, not knowing what the next days are going to bring, and then that kind of very slow recovery from coma to emergence, and then kind of quite reduced awareness state, and seeing kind of the amount of that kind of MDT working. I think that was a big part of it for me as well, personally. You're not working in isolation at all when you're working with people with brain injuries. That you've got your physios, you've got your occupational therapists, you've got your rehab assistants. It's very much everyone doing their bit towards a common goal. So yeah, that was definitely always kind of the plan for me, once I realised that speech and language therapy was a career that wasn't just about teaching people to talk, which is the
Yeah.
stereotypical view, isn't
Indeed, indeed.
it? And yeah, I think it's also interesting around the PDOC, this idea that for speech and language therapists in that MDT or interdisciplinary team, that we are in a fairly unique position, because we are the communication specialists and we are the swallowing specialists, and so we can really bring something to the team that other people can't, just in the same way that physiotherapists are the mobility specialists, the positioning specialists, etc. And so it's just back to what you were saying around that kind of key role. We've all got a part to play. And I remember hearing from speech therapists at the Royal Hospital for Neurodisability, they were saying, there's a really nice link in literature between language and consciousness. And like you say, it's not about speaking necessarily, but it is about communicating it in some way, isn't it? And that's what we're looking at with PDOC
Yes,
patients. Yeah.
yes. And I think the work that's been done there, and of course Amy Pundall has done such wonderful work, and the guidelines that were produced in 2019 for speech and language therapists have been immensely helpful in translating the research into a really good summary document about how to work on responses, whether it's to sound or music, refining relevant stimuli right the way through to working with patients who are emerging, perhaps with a kind of a yes/no technology.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting time to work in this area. I think there's been lots of guidelines, lots more research that's coming through from a speech and language point of view, whether that's to do with communication or swallowing. It's interesting just to kind of be part of a community where these things are coming through more and more. And so, I would say if you're a speech therapist out there listening to this who's maybe occasionally seeing these sorts of patients, I know sometimes people can feel a little bit out of their depth, but there is lots of information out there from, like you say, Amy Pundle at the Royal Hospital has written these guidelines, and there's and obviously get in touch with ourselves on our Twitter page as well. We're happy to kind of offer some signposting, because as myself and my co-hosts say all the time, we are not the experts. We are learning as well. There's always room to be learning from each other. And so if people have got things that they would like to share or questions they want to ask, then it would be great to kind of start a conversation around that.
And it might be good to, I don't know how the podcast works, but maybe to tweet the link to the guidelines, the 2019 guidelines for speech and language therapists as well, as a live link might be good.
I think that would definitely be something that I would do, because actually just with our last episodes or a couple of episodes ago that went out, we covered some more specific assessments for speech and language therapists, and I'm trying to up my Twitter game and tweet more, and I've tweeted out a list of the specific assessments we spoke about, and it was nice to see people kind of engage a bit more, so I need to do better. And that's a great thing to put out there, and have people kind of more readily access. So this has kind of come from, because I did one of your training courses on your training site around kind of the role of media and the representation of brain injury, and it was so interesting to just kind of consider how what we see on television or movies or reads and books or magazines, how that's impacting on family experiences and their expectations of what will happen to their family member, or in the short term and the long term, I guess. So what do you feel are kind of the key things that you see when you're looking at kind of media representation of brain injury?
Well, the key thing you see is short term comas in intensive care. You'll see a lot of that. Mm-hmm. And then you'll see patients who are represented as having been in a coma for 5, 6, 7 years, presumably not a coma, but the vegetative state, technically, suddenly awakening and getting up to shoot people or asking for a cup of tea or declaring undying love. Fiction writers love a good coma plot, don't they? And you also, of course, see news reports of miracle awakening. So the trope of miracle awakening is a very, very dominant one in the media, and of course hooks on to the hope families have in ways that can be profoundly unhelpful at a certain point if that's completely divorced from reality for their loved one.
Yeah, it's so difficult, isn't it? Because I get that for films and for TV shows, you know, that makes for a good watch, doesn't it? But it's very much not the reality for, well, I don't know if that would ever be the reality for anyone in that situation.
I mean, if these happen anywhere across the world, they're suddenly made headline news. And often when you track them down, you know, maybe the person was actually just in a minimally conscious state plus, but hadn't been properly assessed. So even those few miracle stories that make the headlines as fact rather than fiction need a bit of sort of archaeological investigation. And of course, you know, the very fact they make headline news is because they're very rare, and often the level of recovery is exaggerated. So I think a degree of realism in the media would help. And however much we like to say, well, we know it's fiction, I think it still fuels the cultural imagination about how we think about this. And then also more fundamentally, I think the media's not on the whole done a good job about the way we all need to grapple with end-of-life decision-making. We've reached a point where technologies can keep us alive at the very borders of life and death, and in a state that some of us would not choose to survive in, other people would. And how you respect individual and indeed group cultures, religions, values, beliefs, is a very important part of kind of maturing society's response to this, family's response to it, and individual's response to it. So we all need to grapple with this issue of what would we choose? What technological intervention, what risks, what uncertainty would we accept? And when would we say, no, enough is enough, I don't want to go through that treatment for an outcome which is unlikely to be the kind of quality of life I would want at the end of it?
Yeah, it is something that I think for those of us kind of on the other side, you know, who have either had that experience or work in that field, we're maybe a little bit more open to having these sorts of conversations. But I certainly hear, you know, lots of people when they suddenly find themselves into that, you know, plunged into this situation, that they're really unsure about, well, what would their dad have wanted, or their wife, or whoever it might be. And yeah, it would be interesting if maybe that could be something that perhaps in the media could be promoted a little bit more, about the importance of having these conversations, or you know, and I suppose ideally having something written into a, you know, a living will or something like that. And I know that there's differences in kind of in different parts of the UK. Up here in Scotland, there's maybe some different legislation versus England and Wales. So,
yeah.
And I admit that I am not clued up enough to speak to the specifics of all of that. But yeah, it's interesting, like you say, just there's so many changes that have happened in society over recent years about how we approach medical care, isn't there?
Yes, and you know, quick ambulance response times, although that seems to be deteriorating, resuscitation on every corner, which of course can do some people a lot of good, but will bring a lot of people back with absolutely devastating brain injury and never leaving hospital. The airflow mattress means you're less likely to die of bed sores. Obviously, the ventilator was a turning point. So there are technological and social changes that I don't think our ethical or communicative abilities have caught up with. And I mean, you're absolutely right about Scotland being slightly different from England and Wales. And if people are listening from parts of America, it'll be different again, or parts of mainland Europe, or what I should now just call Europe, I suppose. There are differences. I think the important thing is that in most countries, there are tools to try and protect autonomy and patient-centered care. And you need to find out what those are in the country, the jurisdiction that you live in, and then make a decision about, are you happy just to write down something in a letter and send us an email to friends saying, look, I ever can't speak for yourself, myself, will you make sure this letter's read out about what my values are? And in England and Wales, that would be called an advance statement. Or you might choose to do a legally binding document. And in England and Wales, that's called an advanced decision, where you say, you know, if I'm severely brain injured and unlikely to regain this level of capacity to make my own decisions about key areas of my life, then I refuse the feeding tube or ventilation. Or indeed, you can choose who you'd like to represent you in best interest decision making, were you to lose capacity. So appoint someone with lasting power of attorney for health and welfare. So in every jurisdiction, there are different tools, but we need public campaigns to make sure citizens are aware of their rights and aware also of what rights they don't have. I mean, so many families I've worked with have thought that the phrase next of kin was a kind of had a legal status. Well, I'm next of kin. And when you say, well, no, next of kin does not give you any decision-making power. It means you're the person the hospital will ring in the middle of the night or discharge the patient to. It doesn't mean you have any decision-making power for another adult. That comes as a huge shock to many family members, because it sounds legalistic, doesn't it? I'm next of kin.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think you're right. That's a really good point that I hadn't necessarily considered myself, that people will take that view that, yeah, well, I'm next of kin, so therefore all decisions come to me. And yeah, you're right that that's not necessarily going to be the case. Yeah.
And medical teams will let you think you're the decision maker, and ask you to even sign so-called consent forms as next of kin until you disagree with them. And then suddenly they'll say, well, actually, you're not the decision maker. And that was a trajectory for a lot of families we work with in our research as well. So there's a kind of collusion that next of kin are the decision maker or part of the team, part of shared decision making. And then when kind of it comes to the crunch, if the medical team don't think the family members are making the right decision or the reasonable decision, that's the point at which family members are told, well, actually, you're not the decision maker. And that's a real problem. We need absolute honesty about this, that medical teams are responsible for ensuring that either they're following an advanced decision, a so-called living will, and it's a patient who's made the decision in advance, or they're operating in the best interest of a patient who cannot now give or withhold consent, and that they've documented that appropriately, consulted with family to make sure it's a patient-centered decision, taking into account the patient's family's wishes, beliefs, and feelings. But I think that's often there's a lack of clarity about that, both in popular culture and in everyday clinical practice.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point that I think everyone listening needs to really just take a moment to reflect on, about how does that impact on us both, you know, personally and professionally, you know, if we are speaking to family members, but also if we are the you know, the next of kin to someone in a hospital. Just to keep in mind that actually that doesn't just give us overriding power to make every decision. And I think you can see why suddenly such difficult conversations can happen, and why you maybe get families becoming really angry and upset, perhaps about maybe feeling like doctors are making decisions that they don't agree with, or you can really see how, you know, there's been obviously over the years some quite high profile cases of disagreements that have happened, and you know, hospitals being on kind of one side of the fence and family members being on the other. And I'm not saying it boils down to just, you know, sorting out, you know, what next of kin really means, but it's all part of a bigger conversation, isn't it?
It is. And of course, some of the family cases that end up in court are divided families as well. And that's, you know, so hard when different family members are pitted against each other. And it breaks my heart. And I think, well, if only that person who clearly gave a strong sense of what they might want to some family members, at least, if only they'd put it in writing, they could have protected their family from being torn apart by a different interpretation of what would be in their best interests. And so that's why I always say we need to think about not just ourselves as professionals or as next of kin, but also as a patient. Any of us could be hit by that bus, have a stroke. You know, life is very, very fragile. And our brains actually are very fragile, even if life continues, even if our hearts continue to beat. So one thing all of us can do is think, how would I protect both myself, but also the people I care about, from being caught in these very difficult situations of trying to work out what I'd want? And you can do it in different formats. I mean, I've recorded a video of me talking about my values and beliefs. And then what I've said is, if you ever end up having to make a best interest decision about me, you must play this video every 20 minutes, repeatedly during the course of the best interest decision-making meeting. And it's my way of inserting myself into that conversation. I mean, I also have an advanced decision, the living will format. I also have given to my partner lasting power of attorney, health and welfare. But if either of those things fail, or if the situation is, you know, ambiguous, then you've got the video of me talking about my values and beliefs.
Yeah, well, yes, I think that's so, it's great to hear that you've got so many different ways of making sure that your voice will be heard, if in the, you know, in touch with this never happened, but if in the eventuality that you weren't able to kind of voice your opinion there and then and your thoughts and your feelings, yes, you've got many backups. And
yes,
yeah, Do you, and this is maybe too personal a question, so feel free if you don't want to answer this, but do you think that you would have done all of this had you not had the last few years' experience of speaking to families or having that personal experience yourself? Do you think that you would have taken that step of advanced directives and videos just because you thought this was something to do?
Well, obviously, what happened to my sister Polly and my horror at the way she was treated in a way that was completely incompatible with what I believe she would have wanted informed this. But you know the irony? I did have an advanced decision before Polly's accident, and it was Polly and Polly's knowledge of the Mental Capacity Act and her work as an advocate that encouraged me to do it. She talked about advanced decisions both to me and my mother. And I and my mother both had advanced decisions. Polly had never got round to doing her own.
Wow.
So although she'd written and expressed her wishes in letters and things and in many conversations, she hadn't done an advanced decision in a legally binding form. And it meant at that point in history, at least, and we're talking about a decade ago, when I think there was less emphasis placed on people's values and beliefs, and there was more emphasis on the diagnosis. Well, is she in a permanent vegetative state or not? At that point in history, we were unable to protect her from ongoing life-sustaining treatment that everyone who knew her well was clear she would not have chosen to accept. Do you? Is this a too personal question? Have you written down or recorded in any form your wishes?
I have written just a document I've written myself and have saved that my husband can access, but I've got that slight cognitive dissonance that I'm sure lots of us have of knowing that this is a very good thing to do, but haven't quite taken the step myself. But you've don't know if inspired is quite the right word for this conversation, but you've renewed my motivation to, to know that this is something to do. And I know every time I meet a family, and like exactly like you say, it's an awful situation for family members to be in. And if I could do something to save my husband, my sister, any, extra hardship and grief over that, then yes, it's the thing to do, isn't it? We all need to
Well,
do it.
it's horses for courses. I mean, you think the living will, the advanced decision doesn't suit everyone. I happen to have very strong views that fit well with an advanced decision. Whereas other people would much more, well, I'd love someone to trust who I trust to make the decision. And other people, again, are happy with just a value statement and then to let doctors interpret that. And other people just feel they don't know what they'd want.
Yeah.
Or perhaps what they'd want is all the treatment and to be kept alive, whatever. In which case, an advanced decision can't demand treatment, it can only refuse treatment. Just as when we have capacity, we can't demand treatment, but we can only consent to or refuse what's on offer. So I think it's not that I think everyone should have an advanced decision. I think we all need to be aware of how much we care about whether our own values and beliefs inform treatment decisions, and then we record that in a way that will work for us, or have the conversations in a way that will work for us. But certainly, for people who have strong views about they wouldn't want treatment under certain circumstances, nothing is as good as an advanced decision. And it does remove the burden. I have to say, when I was fighting to try and have life-sustaining treatment stopped for my sister, even though I had the strength of knowing her wishes, it was still an incredibly painful thing to do. It was, of course, even the more painful because we lost, and I could not make sure her wishes were protected. But it's a very traumatic thing for family members to go through. So it is a bit of a gift to family to give them the tools to act as an advocate for you, or family, of course, I mean, or friends, as I do on.
So what you're saying reminds me of the book The Last Act of Love by Kathy Retzenbring. And yes, that I feel like that is that kind of sums up really what all of this is about, isn't it? Whether that is about continuing treatment or not. It's about thinking what is the thing that my nearest and dearest would want, and like you say, whether that's a family member or a friend.
And I think digital has been really interesting over the last 10 years because you've seen that disruption of the diagnostic determinism of, well, unless someone's in a permanent vegetative state, you must give them treatment. And that's just really old-fashioned now and seen as incompatible with the Mental Capacity Act and incompatible with person-centered care. And you've seen some very interesting cases which they're often so vivid. I don't know if you ever watched a court case in the Court of Protection. You can do so with the support of an organization my sister runs with colleagues now called the Open Justice Project. But those observing, and you can do it all online now, the live court case where complex best interest decisions are being made, and everyone involved is trying to ensure the voice of the patient is heard, whether they're unconscious or just judged as incapable of making a decision about a certain issue, whether where they live or whether to have a cesarean section or whether to have a leg amputated. The careful unpacking of how did this person live their life? How did they express themselves? What did they enjoy? They don't have an advanced decision. They don't have a value statement, but let's try and bring this person and their entire personality and approach to life into the courtroom and ensure that is central. And there's been a sea change in that. I mean, some of these court cases are incredibly moving in the way that they try and honour the individual.
Yeah, I've not watched them, but I've read the kind of the documents that come from these cases. And yeah, you can really the kind of humanity leaps off the page, and you can really hear from kind of judges' decisions that they really care about what they are discussing, and they're really it's so person-centered and so values-based, and it's again, it's very a very difficult situation, but it's nice to hear that it's not being done in such a clinical way as it perhaps was once upon a time. Yeah. And I'm aware of the time, Jenny. So we've obviously spoken a bit about kind of media and kind of representation. We've had lots of discussion around kind of best interests and things. And one of the things I know that you had done previously that I think maybe links to this idea was a few years ago you did something called the Before I Die Festival. Could you speak a little bit about kind of what that was for people not familiar with it? And I would love to hear if there was ever any plans for anything like that again.
So it grew out of my back of an envelope analysis, I suppose, of Polly's situation very early on, where I thought, what needs to change to give justice to people like my sister? And I thought, well, the law needs to get sorted out and clinical practice needs to be improved. And one of the things I wrote down was, social change, cultural awareness. And so grasping that, I organized a festival to encourage people to talk about not just funerals and the music they wanted, which I think we talk about in a relatively relaxed fashion. But to also talk about, the fact we're all mortal, we're going to die, and what kind of deaths do we want? It's not a question of if, it's a question of when and how. And to try and overcome some of the taboos, and also to ensure that people had access to the tools and the information about death and dying. So I started kind of having conversations with people about, well, what kind of events, what might be run, and it absolutely escalated. I mean, this was very early on in the kind of death awareness movement, I suppose. Although the hospice movement, of course, and organizations like Dying Matters have done a lot of work in this field. But taking it outside that to a more general kind of engagement, I was met with such enthusiasm. There was I saying, oh, it's a taboo, but actually people were eager to talk about it and to organize events. So I think, I mean, we had dozens of events, from tours of cemeteries, looking at the history of cemeteries, to academic panels on advanced decision making, to theatre about assisted dying, music, art, poetry. It was so many people kind of volunteered their contribution to a 360 degree engagement with the end of life. And I think we had over 600 people come in the end to the events, and the conversations were amazing. It was very exciting. It had a huge amount of energy. And yes, it has been repeated. Professor Celia Kitzinger, my colleague and sister, took it to York the following year. And in fact, there have been Before I Die festivals now in Australia and America. I'm in touch with people who ask for advice and then organize their own festivals. And of course, I'm not the originator of this. There were other people doing parallel things. There was Pushing Up Daisies the year before my event in Oxford. There was an event at the Barbican. So this is about a parallel emergent kind of social enthusiasm, with different people being pivots at different points in time. And then organizations like Dying Matters and the hospice movement being key. They've set up there's obviously a Dying Awareness Week every year. So I think there's a lot of energy coming from different directions and an awareness that we need to tackle this. And I think, again, things have changed over the last 10 years for the better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I think we're maybe in a situation where we're more open to having these conversations. Once upon a time, it was very much, don't talk about it. We all knew that the reality of, death does come to us all. I suppose the conversation that we've had, it's about the people in that kind of in-between stage, for want of a better way of putting it. And it's just about having these conversations, isn't it? I personally think it's great that there's more and more people willing to have these conversations to, and it becomes something that can be talked about in a bit more of a relaxed way, rather than it being something to dread or to feel it needs to be something that we really sit down and discuss in great detail all the time. And it needs to be something that we just kind of, not accept, but we're aware it's going to happen. And how can we make the best of it? Jenny, like I say, I feel like we've covered loads, and I personally could chat for hours with you, but I'm aware that we don't have hours. So is there anything else that you would like to kind of mention or cover before we think about wrapping up?
I think I just want to say, along with the guidelines for SLTs that I recommended, which are hosted on the Royal Hospital for Neurodisability website, and I'm sure you'll put out the link, I want a plug for the e-learning that I've developed with the team at the Komen Disorders of Consciousness Research Centre. So you mentioned you did the course, I think, on media representation of Komen. But we also have courses on introducing PDoc, on caring for PDoc patients, which looks at all the different specialities involved and the roles people within the MDT take, and then also has a course on communicating with families and another one on law, ethics and best interest decision making. So I hope some people who listen might be interested in taking these online courses. They just take half day or a day each, and they're fairly interactive and fun and can be done in your own time. And if you are, then the web address for that is cdoctraining.org.uk. So that's CDOC training.org.uk. And I hope somebody might be interested in joining one of those courses.
Yeah, well, like I say, I highly recommend checking out the training site. It's a really good resource, no matter what level of training you've had previously or your kind of job role. There's something in there that we can all learn from. Thank you so much for giving up some of your evening to speak to me, Professor Kitzinger. It's been so lovely to speak to you.
It's been lovely to speak to you. I've really enjoyed our conversation, Helen.
The opinions and views expressed in this podcast are of the individual and should not be considered professional advice. If you have a brain injury, suspect you have a brain injury, or think someone you know has a brain injury, please seek dedicated professional advice.